Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator, and I am only standing here to ask you please to silence cell phones or anything that might disrupt the evening's presentation. I will leave the substantive introduction to our trustee, Jean Parker Pfeiffer. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. I'm so glad you guys came out on a rainy night. Yes, sorry. Now can you hear me?
Yes.
I wanted to introduce Vishan Chakrabarty, who has had such an interesting career, and his book is one thing, but I just want to review with you for a moment his professional career, which gives him so much background for what he is writing about. He is currently a professor of architecture, teaching part-time at Columbia, because he is also a partner at Shop Architects, and for those of you who don't know Shop Architects, they designed the Barclays Center. They are working now on the new Domino Sugar Factory design for the whole complex there and several buildings, and also one of those very tall, skinny buildings on West 57th Street, among many, many other things. They also do a lot of city planning. He was previously an executive vice president of the related companies, 2005 to 9, and at that point he worked on the redesign of Moynihan Station and the Hudson Yards. He also was director of the Manhattan office of the New York City Department of City Planning from 2002 to 5, and he worked on an amazing array of projects, including the number 7 line, the reconstruction of Lower Manhattan after 9/11, the High Line, Lincoln Center renovations, and Columbia University expansion into Manhattanville at 125th Street. So he has an MArch from Berkeley, a Master of City Planning from MIT, a BA in Art History and Engineering from Cornell. So I just wanted to say there were many things I loved about this book. One is that it's very passionate. Two is that he uses a lot of wonderful diagrams. I love charts and diagrams, and they're so great you almost have to make yourself go back to read the text, which I'm sure he labored over, but the diagrams are fantastic. And then I think at a time when so many sociologists are saying that New Yorkers are among the least happy people, however they measure that, that I love the fact that he talks about the element of joy in urban living. And a lot of us really do love urban living. So without further ado, Vishan.
Thank you, Jean. Thanks very much. And thank you to the library and for all of your hospitality and for coming out on such an inhospitable night. I very much appreciate it. Jean was wonderful. She came to my office and actually discussed. It's always nice to receive an invitation where there's this sort of warm welcome and an actual kind of dialogue before the event, just so that I get more of a sense of maybe who you are and what the library is about. And our urban institutions are part of what makes cities great. And so thank you for all of your work. So this is a somewhat new lecture in the sense that the first third of the lecture is basically about the book and talks about items and ideas in the book, excuse me. And the last two-thirds talks about maybe how to implement some of those ideas. And it's through our work at CHOP, because I only know how to talk about the ideas beyond the book in terms of actually trying to practice what one preaches. And hopefully, there are things you may like, there are things you may grossly dislike in that practicing of what I preach, and I hopefully you'll challenge me on that in terms of questions and answers and so forth. I was asked before the lecture when the book came out, and it was a couple of years ago, and it has been a fascinating couple of years for me in the sense that this book came out in a context of a number of other books that were coming out about the strength and importance of cities, books from economists, books from public health experts, books from environmentalists. And so it really sits in dialogue with all of that other work, which I'm very happy about. It also sits in a time when we, I think, as a country, as a society, and as even at a global level, are kind of deeply disheartened by much of what we encounter when we read the newspaper, understand what's happening at the federal level. And yet I have this extraordinary optimism when I talk about cities because it's where all the action is. It's, you know, I've had the honor and the privilege of meeting mayors from around the country over the last couple of years, and mayors are doing such great work. At scales of small towns, at scales of large cities, they're impacting climate change, they're trying to do things to create human capital. They are our best political leaders, I think, without doubt. There's a great book by a friend of mine named Ben Barber who wrote a book called If Mayors Rule the World, and it's all about the effectiveness and the fact that there's nothing particularly ideological about picking up your garbage. So mayors can't afford to be partisan. They actually have to do things for their constituents. And so this first image is from the book, and it's one of my favorite images. And I should say that I wrote this book with a great research team, students of mine from Columbia, as well as just a brilliant, brilliant Swiss Army knife of a guy who now works for me at CHOP named Ryan Lovett, who did many of these diagrams and helped the book. I kid that the book is kind of a children's book for adults. In the sense that these are complex topics. Cities are very, very complex things, and we wanted a way to use graphics to convey to lay people, not just to architects and urbanists and developers and people who know the field, how to talk about some of these issues. And the first image is really about this notion that this isn't any particular city. It's kind of an idealized city. This idea that our cities could be a place of great cultural diversity, of social equity and mobility, of environmentalism. There is no city in the world like this yet. But what's very clear from the data, and the book is filled with data, and it's very, very intensely researched and often challenged data, about the strength of cities from a number of different perspectives. From the economic perspective, 90% of the United States gross domestic product is generated by 3% of its landmass, about 86% of our jobs. So basically, our cities are the wealth of our nation. They are, and if you look in today's economy, in the service economy, in the technological sphere, we're finding more and more data about the fact that when people live in close proximity to one another, that they interact and they innovate. And so if you look at company creation, patent registration, you find a very clear correlation between the density at which people live and the economic prosperity that they get to be a part of. If you look at the environment and climate change, it might surprise you to find out that people who live in Hong Kong are the greenest people on Earth. This is because they largely take mass transportation and live in fairly small dwelling units. The average New Yorker uses about one-third of the energy that the average American does, and this is not because we use a particular brand of light bulb or floor cleaner. It's because, again, we use mass transit. We live in apartments that heat and cool each other. They're thermally much more efficient than single-family homes. This is something that's highly impactful at the scale of millions of people in terms of climate change. And then if you look at other issues, public health, childhood obesity, stress levels associated with commuting. There's an amazing Swedish study that came out that's talked about in the book about the fact that as commuting distance and time increases, divorce rates increase. As commutes increase, childhood obesity increases and chronic heart disease increases. The AMA is on to this. There are definite public health dangers associated with sprawl, which is interesting because, of course, the stereotype is exactly the opposite, that somehow cities are bad for you and that somehow living out, quote, in quote, nature is good for you. And so there's all sorts of interesting ideas about public health and joy, and there's interesting statistics about happiness that are coming out as well. And then in terms of social change and social mobility and, you know, some of the things that our current mayor ran on, but also if you think about, say, the Arab Spring, you'll notice that those images didn't come from the deserts of Egypt. They came from the heart of our cities. One could argue that social change in our nations could not happen without what happens in terms of the streets and public spaces of our cities. And so if you just go down this checklist of metric by metric, you find that our cities are incredibly powerful, and there are more and more people from very different fields, from health to economy to environmentalism that are looking at this and starting to understand the significance of cities in our world today. And yet, we have structured a world since World War II largely that is completely working against urbanism. And so part of what I'm going to argue and part of what the book argues is that the American landscape today is not something that was just a natural consequence of market forces. If you walked around this country 100 years ago, you would find cities that were much denser, cities that were actually more transit-oriented, and you would find much more natural kind of unspoiled landscape 100 years ago than you would find today. And that is because of direct government intervention in terms of people's choices, in terms of how they live. It starts really at a tremendously significant scale in 1956 under President Eisenhower with the largest piece of infrastructure we've ever built, which is the National Highway and Defense Act, building the interstate highway system, both to diffuse the population in the event of a Soviet nuclear attack, as well as a desire to segregate our cities. There was a lot of redlining of African Americans in this period. And so both an arms race and a kind of fear of race that drove us towards diffusion of our population. And we live with the vestige of those decisions today. What we spend on roads, which many Americans think should be free, what we spend on roads is about four times what we spend on rail-based transit. It is an extraordinary amount of public munificence that falls on our roads. Even if you look at the stimulus bill that was passed in 2010, you'll find that the majority of that money that was spent on, quote, infrastructure, right, was spent on roadway projects around the country. Then if you look at energy subsidies, that the government puts a tremendous amount of money into fossil fuels. There was that whole blow up around Solyndra and all of that. That is such a distraction. The fact is, we put so little money into renewable energy sources as opposed to fossil fuels and keeping the price of gasoline artificially low. And in fact, in terms of that, there's other information in the book about, you know, our gas taxes around the country. They're about, on average, it's about 48, 49 cents a gallon. Most economists will tell you that if you countered in the negative externalities of gasoline usage in terms of, you know, if you own a factory and you pollute a river, you're expected to clean up the river. If you drive a car, the amount of burden you're placing in terms of pollution, congestion, depressed land value around highways, that gasoline tax would actually bring you up to about $10 for a gallon of gasoline. And so we're not paying anywhere near the cost of what we use in terms of gasoline. And then there's, of course, the enormous government investment put into housing. Now, many of you would say, what government investment put into housing? Well, it's called the mortgage interest deduction. The government spends about $100 billion annually subsidizing what almost every economist on both the left and the right part of the political spectrum agree is very bad housing policy that largely favors middle to upper middle income housing owners to buy larger homes than they need. If you drew a Venn diagram of the places where the New York Times editorial board and the Wall Street Journal editorial board agreed on something, this would probably be the thin little sliver, because both papers basically agree that this is very bad policy. It largely favors the suburbs. The vast majority of that $100 billion a year is drawn down by large suburban homeowners. And remember, we're talking about homes with a married couple with an income of $1.1 million, where the median home price in the country is somewhere in the $200,000 range. There's absolutely no reason that this deduction should exist, and yet it's a massive expenditure compared to what developers get to use to build low-income housing. So if you look at what developers use in terms of tax credits and so forth after 86 tax reform under Ronald Reagan, you find that there's still very, very little money to build affordable housing in comparison to the money that there is to subsidize large suburban homes. And so under that regime, and as we entered this century, we found that we arrived at a moment that we didn't say, well, let's start investing in our cities. We actually doubled down on this very bad idea. We created subprime mortgages, we loosened lending standards under George W. Bush, and we got to a point that just before the collapse, and this recession was very much caused by what happened in the real estate industry, let's not kid ourselves, before the collapse, 80%, our housing debt as a nation reached almost 80% of our gross domestic product. And then you're starting to see the beginning of the kind of deleveraging after the crash in that graph. And what you'll notice about that graph is the gray is the debt attributable to single-family homes as opposed to condominiums, which is still a fairly low amount of housing production nationwide. What this has resulted in, and it's very clear, is an American dream that is broken. And that's because it's a dream that is misunderstood. This notion, how many of you believe that the American dream is about owning a house, a car, and having a patch of grass behind your house? Or how many of you have come to believe, whether you believe in that or not, I guess what I'm asking is, how many of you have that as the understanding of the American dream? This is a complete perversion of the idea. If you look back to when the American dream is first written about in the 1930s, it has nothing to do with a house and a car. It actually is all about the idea of opportunity and the notion that people could come from any class background, men, women, any race, and could actually achieve a better life for themselves. It's an extraordinary idea. And it is driven by the fundamental idea that over time, prosperity grows for your family, that your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren are better off than you are. And yet, because we've perverted this basically into a dream of consumerism, of the bigger house and the bigger car and the bigger TV set, and then the TV set doesn't fit in the bigger car, and so you need a bigger car, and then it doesn't fit in the garage, and so you need a bigger house, right? What that has done is it's left 11 million Americans still underwater in terms of how much they own versus how much they owe. And it's led to an entire generation of people known as the millennials, some 80 million people, who are understanding that their chances of prosperity are lower than their parents, which is not the American dream. Richard Florida and others have called for a reconstitution of the American dream that is again built around opportunity. This could be my parents' story, that we came here with $32 in 1967. But the basic idea that, and it's interesting if you think about this in the context of the immigration debate going on in Washington, but the notion that people work hard, they send their kids to hopefully not too expensive school, and their kids actually go out into the world and do better than they did. And their prosperity increases over time. And it's fairly clear that a huge part of that equation is having those kids move to a city. And so I'll explain that a bit. And what's also interesting about that generation, the millennial generation, is they are being, I think, assaulted with the full force of climate change in a way that I don't think that the generations that came before them fully understand. And one of the things that I think is becoming clearer to them and quite clear to me is this notion that retrofitting a 20th century technology, this idea that you're going to somehow put windmills and solar panels and plug in your electric car and solve the climate change crisis for that generation and the generations that follow, is simply buying into that consumer idea again. Let me give you an example, the electric car. In most of this country, when you plug your electric car in, you are plugging it into an electrical grid that is powered by a coal-fired power plant. So you've transferred your tailpipe emissions into a smokestack, but you got to buy something, and we're Americans, we like to be able to buy something, and we got to feel better about ourselves. And so fundamentally, that is not going to solve this enormous problem we have at any kind of scale. However, if we live in more compact circumstances, use primarily rail-based methods of transportation, what we'll find is that at scale, we will affect the climate change crisis quite dramatically, And we will also do something that I think is counterintuitive, which is this idea of actually saving nature. Because the most, I think, unthought through idea about the suburbs is this notion that you are somehow getting reconnected to nature and that you're doing something, therefore, for nature. If you really love nature, you shouldn't try to live in it, fundamentally. And so this is not just a cartoon. This could easily be a diagram of Hong Kong. What people don't understand about a place like Hong Kong is only about a third of Hong Kong Island is used for housing and development. About two-thirds is country park. And so if you want to go hiking in Hong Kong, you don't have to go very far from the footsteps of your apartment door. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. Now, that's a level of density that maybe most Americans aren't willing to live in today. But the point is that from an environmental perspective, it's inarguable that there are great, great advantages to it. And so people will point to cities and they'll say, well, they're heat islands. Don't 85% of greenhouse gases come from buildings? All of that's true. But the fundamental point is that you have to look at carbon use per capita. And if you look at carbon use per capita, it's very clear that you're getting much, much more performance out of people who live in cities than you are for people who have to drive to get a quart of milk. And then there are the lifestyle issues. And we talked about this notion of joy. And I think a lot of people, and I'm astounded because I actually don't think, since the book came out, I've had the privilege of lecturing in a lot of places around the country. And we sitting in New York or people sitting in San Francisco have no idea what's happening in this country in terms of urbanization. Virtually every, first of all, it's interesting. There's only one Republican mayor left in the country. The mayor of Indianapolis, who is a fairly progressive guy, and by that I mean obviously of major cities. The major cities throughout the South have Democratic leadership. Throughout almost every city I go to, you see efforts to build mass transit, to build multifamily housing. People are trying to figure out parks, they're trying to figure out schools. And what the reason for that is that millennials, so again, millennials, people born in the 1980s and 1990s, some 80 million of them nationwide. There's an article in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago about the fact that college-educated millennials, this is an astounding statistic, age 25 to 34, the people in that age bracket, the number of those people living within 3 miles of a city center since 2000 has gone up 37%. We experience this anecdotally in our own business. We have about 200 architects, most of whom are millennials. And what we're finding is, even after they have kids, they're trying to stay in cities, and if they feel like New York or Brooklyn has become too expensive to them, for them, they're not moving to Montclair, they're moving to St. Louis. There's an urban homesteading that's happening around the country, where if people feel like they can't afford the sort of big coastal cities, they are recreating that form of urban life where you can walk and bike and, you know, take your kids to school without having to get into a minivan in cities all across the country. And so cities all across the country, the mayors are now caught on to this and they're competing to get human capital, which is why they're building great parks and they're trying to improve school systems and they're trying to do things about crime. I would stand here today and wager that the city of Detroit will be saved in part by an extraordinary millennial energy that has retaken the heart of Detroit, because one thing Detroit does not have is an affordability problem. And so this basic idea that if given the choice between, you know, driving between your single-family home and your office park, and therefore drinking while driving and road rage or texting while driving, which is now about 30% of the accidents in the United States. By the way, the number one cause of infant mortality worldwide is not malaria, it's not HIV/AIDS, it's auto accidents. So this is somewhat of a worldwide phenomena, this problem, right? Versus taking a light rail, feel free to have a drink or two before you get on the light rail. Work on your smartphone before you get on the or while you're on the light rail, and actually save time, which I would argue is one of the most precious commodities in a service economy. And one of the problems we now face associated with this is the fact that there is new data coming out that people like me and many other urbanists talk about the strengths of walkable urbanism. But we're starting to correlate high walk score zones. I'm sure many of you know what walk score is. That places the walk score is this software that basically rates how walkable your neighborhood is. So the higher higher the score, the higher the walk score, the more walkable. That the higher the walk score, the more expensive your neighborhood. So this tells you a couple of things. One, people want to live this way because as you build more walkable neighborhoods around the country, it creates demand. And what that then, of course, does is it means that housing prices go up. Now, we've found in the book, it talks about this. We talk about a density of 30 units per acre, which is about the density you need. That's planning jargon for a density that's basically comparable to about Brownstone Brooklyn, or the West Village is a little denser, maybe about 40 acres per acre. That you need about that much density to support a mass transit system. Less density than that means you're not going to get sufficient riders for that mass transit system. Now, what's interesting is in our work, we found that of the zoned land in the United States, only about 12% of the land is zoned that high. In other words, what planners have done is they've gone around the country and they've down-zoned land at the behest of their communities. Communities want less density, all those people, all those cars. And so what happens is you get sprawl. Right, and so the supply of walkable urbanism is incredibly constrained, even though the demand is there. And so what that's done is it's created an affordability crisis. Right, and so clearly we have one in this city. If you really want to see a cautionary tale in this, I invite you to go to San Francisco, which has so regulated its housing market, which has made it so difficult to build a single piece of multifamily housing, that the city's become extraordinarily unaffordable. Portland. Portland has an urban growth boundary. Portland has lots of incoming population, and I talked to the mayor of Portland just a few weeks ago, and he said, we're going to have to build towers, which is a new idea for people in Portland. But if they don't accept towers, what they're going to have to accept is their city is going to become very unaffordable very quickly. And so this is one of the fundamental problems we have in terms of supply, demand, and how we're thinking about building our cities. We're also not building the infrastructure we need. And by that, I don't just mean mass transit and sewer lines and water lines, which are traditional definitions of infrastructure, but I mean what I like to call an infrastructure of opportunity, schools, culture, parks, libraries, because those are the things that create social mobility in our society. And it's fundamentally important that we base density, not just for density's sake, but actually build it on top of an armature of an infrastructure of opportunity. So this is one of the last slides in the book. What it talks about is taking all of those suburban subsidies that our federal government doles out in its largesse, and taking it and splitting them between deficit reduction and actually what I call a new piece of legislation called the American Smart Infrastructure Act, or ASIA for short, with the basic idea that, like our competitors are doing, that we reinvest in our cities, we build great mass transit systems, we build great public school systems and great urban park systems, and that in so doing, we will not only create a better quality of life for our people, but we will actually create so much economic prosperity that we can get ourselves not only out of the deficit, but we can create a more prosperous, environmentally sustainable, and socially mobile society. And so I try to argue in the book that cities, this kind of thing that sits right under our nose that we don't really bother to think about or write about or talk about all that often, could easily be the silver bullet that we're looking for to solve an enormous number of the problems that we face today as a society. At a global level, this is even more pressing. We worry about Ebola and terrorists and all sorts of other, frankly, quite made-up threats in comparison to the greatest threat we face on the planet. Now, many of you may have read that the planet is urbanizing very rapidly and that there are now more people living in cities than in rural areas. This is very commonly said in schools across the country and around the world. The problem is in our definitions, because the world is not urbanizing. The world is suburbanizing at an incredibly rapid rate. We now have 7 billion people on this planet, 2 billion of whom have moved into the middle class. We've seen a worldwide drop in poverty that is staggering, actually, in the last two decades. And that's very good. That's very good if you're the average person in Brazil or India or China. The problem is that as those people move into the middle and upper middle class, what they're doing is they are emulating the lifestyle that we've created here in terms of suburban living. And so people are hankering for that house and those two cars in the driveway. And so everywhere I go around the world, what I see is this form of globurbia that is taking over so much of the land in the world. And what I really worry about is that it's one thing for a few hundred million people in the West to live this way. For 2 billion people to live this way will put a strain on planetary resources that we are not going to be able to solve unless we change the way in which we are living worldwide. And I believe that this country has a special responsibility in this regard because it is still an arbiter of worldwide culture. And I believe that if we can advocate for living in a very prosperous, green, progressive way in our cities, that could become a kind of global model. So what's interesting about all that is that at that 30 units an acre, that brownstone density, the 7 billion people who inhabit this planet could all live in Texas, leaving the rest of the country, or leaving the rest of the world, I should say, for nature and agriculture. Now, I'm not suggesting we all move to Texas. I know we have some Texans here. What I'm trying to say is not so much that we all move to Texas, but rather that we don't really have a population crisis in the way that it's been made out to be. Birth rates are declining. The work of my colleague at Columbia, Jeff Sachs, is rather extraordinary in terms of the Millennium Development Goals. There's some certainty that worldwide birth rates will stabilize and that we're going to reach about 10 billion people and probably peak out at the end of this century. Now, what I worry about with my friends who are environmentalists, and I consider myself among them, is that, you know, you can't wish away people. We have, as a species, we have a very, very bad track record of wishing away people. Right? And so we have to find a way for the 7 billion people who live on the planet today and the 10 billion people who live on the planet by 2100 to live in the planet in a logical, sustainable way. Because those people aren't going anywhere, and they shouldn't go anywhere. We should treasure each of them. So the problem is we don't live very logically today. We use an enormous amount of the landmass of the planet, and we are increasingly making that a sort of fossil fuel-driven environment. Now, what I find kind of fascinating about all of this is that it is hard going out. I'm talking to people who live in cities, so this isn't so hard. It's hard going out into the middle of the country and saying, you know, the way you live is subsidized, right? And you should really think about changing the way you live. I wrote an op-ed in the Times a couple of months ago, and it was reprinted in the Dallas Morning News, and they printed my email address with it. And I got some really, really interesting email from the suburbs of Dallas. What I've come to realize about this is that it's not people's fault. People live in a very, very complex time. And to go to people and say, well, if you lived in a denser circumstance and you took your kids to school on the subway, you'd be better off. People are confounded by that thought. And I can understand why. I mean, we live maybe not in the most complex time that humanity's ever lived in, but we have a window into that complexity that no one has ever had before. This is 3 minutes of worth of Twitter usage in cities around the world. To just give you a little taste of what social media does in terms of how we now look at the world. This is a couple of years old. It's the first known image of the universe because we can now map the universe. We have a lens into that kind of complexity. Or this is an image of server downloads on the internet, geographically based. And so the green is the Americas, the red is Asia, my favorite is the white is unknown. So someone's using the internet that we don't know about out there. Or the Human Genome Project, where again, we have a lens into the complexity of our own bodies that we've never had before. Or Obamacare, which, love it or hate it, is certainly complex. Or ISIS troop movements. And my point with all of this is just that this is an image of Kowloon Walled City. It's the densest construction ever made by humanity. And this is what people picture when you go to talk to them about living in cities. And so that's one of the things that as an architect, as a practicing architect, I feel that we, that our profession needs to help with. Because people have horrible stereotypes that don't stay true to form. This is a picture of a Japanese farming village that I took flying out of Narita Airport, which is quite far out from Tokyo. And it reminds me of the farm where my father was born. And this is the way farms look in most of the world. The farmers live in clusters. They farm the fields around their village. And if you think about that village, it's built on a spine where it's fairly easy to supply infrastructure in terms of power and water and sewage and so forth, as opposed to the Jeffersonian madness of every farmer living out on their plot of land and trying to supply infrastructure to that farmer. So my point in saying this isn't about everyone living in Hong Kong. There are different scales at which people can live that still follow the principles of dense living, whether it's farming or small town America, which is different, by the way, from the suburbs. Small town America has a main street, fairly small houses, you can walk around. So I think part of our job is to get away from people's stereotypes of density and actually, so this is Hong Kong, the traffic of Sao Paulo, and actually explain to people in better terms what density could bring to their lives. And as architects, I'm going to use a word that you're never supposed to use as an architect, or at least not in school, which is the term beauty. Because I think if you're going to go to the lay public and say to them, well, look, we think that cities are a better way of life, you know, you have to, you can show them all the economic data and environmental data that you want to show them. You have to prove to them that this is a way that they want to live, raise their families, live with their grandparents, and so forth, right? And so part of what we've come to believe at CHOP is that if you think about the very complex times in which we live, that beauty in our minds is basically it's the human imprint on the anonymous vastness of our times. If you look at all of that data, it's always the thing that reminds you that a human being actually touched this, that makes it feel like it's something that you can connect to. And so in our work, we actually try to embrace the complexity of our times and our technology and what we do in terms of construction, in terms of texture and materiality, but try not to be reductive about it. Try to embrace that complexity, but try to actually carry some sense of human imprint. And this is a big challenge. You know, as an art historian, this is one of my favorite paintings, The Oath of David from 1784. And it is at the cusp of the French Revolution. And David, you know, all these painters painting neoclassicism, painting these allegories from ancient Greece, to try to remind everyone that the idea of creating a democracy in France, that creating the French Republic, right, was the way of creating beauty and order. And that sense of beauty and order lasted for some 200 years in our society until we get to the 60s. And the 60s, there's, in my mind, a necessary kind of social upheaval of that ordering system that's really been in place since the late 1700s. And you get to the 1960s, and as architects, but in virtually every discipline, there's suddenly a sense of chaos. There's huge stylistic debates. The orthodoxy of modernism, which I actually believe comes out of sort of some of the orthodoxy of classicism, runs its course, and we are left with a sort of confounding set of arguments about how one creates beauty in our cities. And what we've come to believe is that given all of that complexity, given all of the issues that I just laid out before you, that we can't possibly rely on this idea anymore of architect as Superman, which has been kind of the archetype through the 20th century, right? That notion of not just Superman in his cape, but Frank Lloyd Wright in his cape. And that instead, you kind of need the crazy misfit skills of the Avengers. And so I have six other partners, and this could easily be a picture of those partners, all kind of wacky, but skills nonetheless. And in fact, not just those partners, but the entire office, and this could easily be a picture of our office, with the notion that in order to solve the challenges that we have before us, that you can't just rely on architecture as a pure idea, but in fact you need the biologist, the poet, the chef, that interdisciplinarity and horizontality in terms of how we think about ideas is critical to solving the problems that we have in front of us. So that's really our office, with an extraordinary array of talent. We live in a very ordered neoclassical building, the Woolworth Building. It's a pleasure to go into that building every day. But even in that building, there are cues about the future. We have built a city, and in fact, most cities around the world are built on a hub-and-spoke model, where there is a central business district and everyone commutes in and out of that district every day. What I find increasingly is that we're moving to what I like to call a networked city model, where there's not just one node where everyone works, right? But there are multiple places across a city like ours. Think about what's happened in this city. We have people who live in Brooklyn, work in Brooklyn, and come to Manhattan once every 6 months. It was unthinkable a decade ago. We have office space in the Flatiron District that's renting for what space near Grand Central rents for. It's extraordinary. Google paid $1.8 billion for an old warehouse building in Chelsea. This is because we are changing the way we think about work, and therefore changing the way we think about neighborhoods, and therefore changing the way in which our cities can be built. And I believe this is very much the future. And one of the things that I'm really on about is this future in terms of the East River. There's some 47 million square feet, by our counting, planned along the East River, most of it along the Brooklyn and Queens waterfront. That red square is Central Park to scale on the East River. And if we used to think of the East River as the edge of our city, increasingly it's becoming the center of our city. There's about 55 million square feet of space around the park. So if you live around the park but don't like development along the river, well, I'd say that people who live in stone houses shouldn't throw glass. This development's incredibly important in terms of the future of the city. And so our work actually starts with the city, and this is the extraordinary linguine of bureaucracy you have to deal with when building along a river. But we started when I was at City Planning, and CHOP was actually commissioned to build out a public waterfront here, get people underneath the FDR and get them out onto the water. And so I'm showing examples like this because, again, I'm trying to put flesh on the bones of the idea that if you believe that cities are great places to live and that they're better for the economy and the environment and society, how are you going to actually instrumentalize that? How are you going to actually show people that you can build a better city in the 21st century? And for young people, this is incredibly important. There's a public pier out here that was built on a city budget. It's the most romantic place in New York. If you can't get a kiss on that pier, just hang out at home. You know, we're rebuilding the mall next to that, this at South Street Seaport, which was very internalized, and trying to make it much more complex, much more open. These are glass shutters that move up and down with the weather. Don't make you feel like you're trapped in a shopping complex, but actually help you enjoy the sort of complexity of the city. We're working on a big affordable housing project down in the Lower East Side called Seward Park, where, again, we're trying to bring light and air down into the subway and this food market that's getting relocated there. And so, again, the sense of civic delight, civic joy, as part of building more density. And that's an idea of that light scoop with light coming down into the subway level. And then Domino, which I'm going to probably close on, actually, because I think Domino, in some ways, is a kind of harbinger of things to come. This is 3 million square feet on the Brooklyn waterfront, sits at an extraordinary bend in the river, right at the center of Brooklyn's skyline on the East River. What happened is there was a 7-year battle to rezone this site. It got rezoned for 3 million square feet. The landowner, after getting it rezoned, sold it to our client. Our client came to us and said, well, the site's rezoned. We could build according to the plan that was approved. We hate the plan. We don't want to spend the next decade of our existence building this plan. So you have a month. Prove to us that we should go through public approvals again. Now, if you're in this industry, that's like asking to return to Guantanamo. Right? That's not something that you normally do, is just simply go back through approvals again. But the site plan was really, really terrible. It built into the floodplain. It was sort of lower, blocky buildings. There is a landmark factory, the Domino Sugar Refinery, that sits in the heart of it. And I actually think that, again, in the world of a denser city, that our landmarks and preservation become that much more important so that we retain that thread of history and fabric. But we went back to the city and went back to the community and said, what if you let us build higher? It's the same density. And people often confuse density and height. But we said, what if we build higher and get out of the floodplain? And not only that, but we don't build right next to one side of the refinery. And we therefore create about 6.5 acres of park. And we aerate these buildings so that light and air gets penetrated back to the community. And we actually step up the scale of these buildings with some very low elements that respond to the scale of Williamsburg, some mid-scale elements that respond to the scale of the refinery and the Williamsburg Bridge, and then some skyline elements that actually talk about a more exuberant skyline for Brooklyn. And one of the most interesting aspects, this passed 29-3 with the community board. It's the first large project that ever passed in favor with this community board. One of the most interesting aspects of this was Williamsburg, they basically said, look, we understand the scale of our neighborhoods changing, but we don't want banal architecture. We don't want all glass buildings. We want something that in some way is evocative of our industrial past. And so one of the things, we tried to do a number of things. These buildings aren't all completely designed, but none of them will be all glass buildings. We're designing 2 of the 4 buildings because we just don't think it's healthy for the city for all of these buildings to be designed by one firm. A lot of the industrial artifacts around the refinery are actually made part of the park. So there's a specificity. And again, I think this is important in terms of advocating for cities, that you actually ground it with a sense of place. It can't be anywhere but where it is. The other thing about this is it's very exuberant architecture in the sky, but it tries to meet the ground responsibly. There are setbacks. There's ground floor retail. This particular client never brings in chain stores, which I think is another very interesting aspect of this, the sort of texture of having independent retail, a school, a community center. I'd like to linger on this image because I actually think this is very important, because one of the most important aspects of this project is not architectural. It's the fact that this is not just housing. There's tech office space that's planned for the refinery as well as another building to the north. And so this is a mix of housing and office, school, community center, retail. And part of the idea here is, again, that network city diagram that I showed you, this notion that people can walk to work, bicycle to work. We don't have billions and billions of dollars to build new subway lines all over the place. So if we can actually create these neighborhoods within our city where people can live, work, and play, that becomes incredibly important. And so in many ways, this whole move of not building next to the refinery is to experience that landmark in the round and to make it really the sort of celebratory center of this whole new neighborhood, the way sort of the Tate Modern does on the South Bank of London, with this idea that, yes, new things can come, different scales can come, but again, there's still this sense of lineage. I'll just end here. So this is a project that has 30% affordable housing. It has this enormous mix of uses. There's preservation, there's parkland, it takes on some of the flooding issues that we have on the river. And again, to me, the most important aspect was to reach out to the community and actually have them approve of the idea that Brooklyn deserves the skyline too. And that skyline should be something that is unique to Brooklyn. The sun will rise and set through that building every day. And I think it will be a kind of extraordinary moment for the borough to suddenly have this kind of symbol out in the world. Because, and I just close on this, that Brooklyn in some ways I think represents a lot of what's happening nationally and a lot of what people are trying to do internationally in terms of creating the mix, the vitality, the notion that there can even be light manufacturing in a city again, and represents, I think, the order we're trying to get to in terms of cities that are more prosperous, more sustainable, and more socially mobile. So I'll end there, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. Thank you. Yes. I don't think I have a one-size-fits-all answer for you, but I do think I was out at a panel in Jersey City recently, and it to me, all of the places that are still connected by rail to our bigger cities are going to fare quite well. So, you know, you're seeing a place like Jersey City actually encounter a lot of new housing. It's starting to look and feel like a place you want to walk around and bike around, which, again, 15 years ago was sort of unthinkable except for the sort of brownstone parts of it. But there are new parts around the PATH station and so forth. So I think those kinds of places will generally be fine. I also think there is a rediscovery of small-town America and people really starting to understand, well, first of all, driving everywhere is a pocketbook issue, right? And so there are people who are definitely trying to work towards, if not owning a car, using a car less and less for their daily activity. And so I think small towns are also experiencing a resurgence. The question I often get, and the places that I'm the most worried about, are the exurbs that were particularly built in the course of the last decade, the places outside of Phoenix and Sacramento and Las Vegas with fairly shoddy housing, with very little access to mass transportation, very spread out. And what's happening in those places is they're getting poorer. And suburban poverty is on the rise in this country. What I worry about is that we, as a in that framework, that we're starting to look more like continental Europe. And, you know, I always find this fascinating. I teach at a fairly liberal school, and you know, progressives are just, well, sure, density is great, but why can't we live in Paris? Well, the Paris we know is about 17% of Paris, right? And those places are lovely, and they're for the wealthy, and the vast majority of people who try to move to Paris end up in a peripheral suburb that is filled with social unrest, incredibly segregated, incredibly bad schools. And so we shouldn't just look at inner city Paris and inner city Barcelona and say, what a wonderful place. And that is a destiny that I hope that we're going to work to avoid in this country, because those are the places that I'm the most worried about. I think that the other kinds of places that you mentioned are going to be fine. Yes.
The
Well, sure. Thank you. It's a great question. I mean, first of all, 7 billion people, those 7 billion people, regardless of whether they live in a city or a suburb, I would argue have the same demand for an iPhone. Right? It's not clear to me that city dwellers, by virtue of being city dwellers, demand more food or more electronics than someone who lives in the suburbs do. What I do know is that city dwellers put much less demand on particularly fossil fuel, which to me is the biggest challenge we confront. That doesn't mean there aren't other very significant resource challenges in the world, but you know, we pretty much know, if you read Jim McKibben's book on Earth, we pretty much know that if we use just about 20% of the known fossil fuels under the crust of the Earth, that we're going to raise the Earth's temperature 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's going to cause catastrophic coastal damage. And so, you know, to me, that is the first order problem in terms of resource demand. And so we know that people who live in transit-based cities, and I want to be careful because there are places like Sao Paulo that look like cities but are actually sort of vertical suburbs. Everyone drives everywhere if you're not taking a helicopter. So there are very resource-intensive cities per capita versus a place like a New York or a London or a Tokyo. But the primary point of the question that I would kind of reverse is that it's not so much what cities cost the rest of the world, it's what the rest of the world costs cities. We are, there's a map in the book that talks about blue states versus red states and what are the donor versus recipient states. And Mayor Giuliani, whom I don't usually agree with, said something that I found really interesting, which is he said that most people in the country vote against their self-interest, which is that, you know, basically blue states are primarily the donor states. They generate most of the economic wealth that is then redistributed to the red states, most of which are economic recipients of government largesse. That's not true for every single state, but it's true generally across the board. If you look at even a planetary level, you'll find that cities are actually the places that are the biggest means of production, and that actually it's our suburban areas that are drawing off of that production for their roads, for their gas lines, for their power lines, and so forth. So I don't know if I fully answered your question. I mean, I do think there are other resource demands that we need to be concerned about in terms of like some of the things you mentioned, like minerals and so forth. But what I'm really very focused on is the basic climate change issue associated with fossil fuel. And that, I think, is our highest order problem in terms of the environment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so our profile of vast urbanization is based upon the liberty which we've all enjoyed, even in the colonial times. Boston and New York and Philadelphia were dictated by who was organizing the cities. So my curiosity is,
Well, I mean, well, look, I mean, first on Detroit, we are doing some work in Detroit, and I'm actually quite optimistic about Detroit. But Detroit is going to centralize. Detroit is huge. I mean, if you look at the scale comparison, it's astonishing. I mean, basically, like New York City, Washington, and Boston all fit in the city limits of Detroit. And it was much, much too sprawling. It's impossible to provide city services across such a huge landmass. And so Detroit's going to centralize. It is going to shrink in parts. I don't know that it's all going to be leveled, but it's clear that there are little pockets, sort of villages that are going to emerge within Detroit. And other places are going to get reforested and things like that. People are talking about urban farming and so forth. I would state what you said a slightly different way about people's liberties. I believe in people's liberties, and I think people should live how they want to live. What the book is trying to highlight, what we're trying to highlight, is that people's choices have been skewed by intervention. And that if you simply leveled the playing field, give you a simple example. If we spent as much on rail as we did on roads at a federal level, would people make the same choices? People have chosen to live in those outskirts because we as a country have made it cheap and possible for that to happen. And so we've subsidized a bunch of stuff. Right, and so what the book is trying to argue is live the way you want to live, but let's take away the subsidies and see what choices people make. And so I wouldn't want to dictate to anyone how they live, but if you told someone that their big, you know, 7,000 square foot house and their two SUVs in the driveway actually is going to cost them about 4, 5, 6 times more than what they're paying for it, would they still live that way? And that, I think, is the conversation. It's a very difficult political conversation to have, but it's, I think, the important conversation to have, especially with these millennials, because I'll tell you, you know, lecturing around the country, one of the things that I've been astonished by is that I've gone to places in the deep south and places that are very, very suburban, and I found almost no geographic divide in response to this talk. What I found is a generational divide. And so what I mean by that is millennials who, look, they grew up with 9/11 and Katrina and the Great Recession and now all of this climate change, they're willing to rethink everything because none of it's working for them as it's been structured, right? For the people who own, you know, get the mortgage interest deduction and get cheap gas and have a big SUV, whether you live in Boston or you live in Dallas, all of it works for you. And so you're much less willing to question it all, right? I had a woman in Chicago come up to me and said, everything you said made sense, just please don't take away my mortgage interest deduction. You know, and that's, you know, that's the thing. Yes, ma'am. So, yeah. So it's interesting, when the stimulus bill was being created and there were a lot of questions about the deficit, which we're talking about a lot less these days than we were back then, Simpson-Bowles actually did recommend bringing the mortgage interest deduction down. Now, it was for deficit reduction, but the CBO did a whole analysis of basically taking the deduction and the cap is $1.1 million for a married couple in terms of their income, of just basically dropping, not their income, excuse me, the price of the house, basically taking that cap down $100,000 a year and slowly, in over the course of 11 years, either eliminating it or bringing it at least down to the median housing price nationwide. What's interesting is the UK had a mortgage interest deduction. They eliminated it. Canada's never had one. Singapore, which has the highest home ownership rate in the world, has never had any kind of intervention in the marketplace. Home ownership rates are largely steady across developed countries, whether there's intervention in the marketplace or not. And so this notion that it's somehow going to collapse the market is a complete fallacy created by the national realty lobbyists who, you know, love the deduction. So I'm not saying it's politically possible or politically easy, but it's hardly like an issue that's going to somehow collapse the U.S. economy. It's just, that's nonsense. Sir?
Years ago, there was an article that Paolo Soleri, who, his idea
Yeah. Arcasanti. Well, you know, because I think back when the environmental movement started in the 60s, it was considered, you know, it was a very niche movement. I don't think it had a lot of popular support, actually. You know, even when Inconvenient Truth came out, there was a sense that this was kind of wacky for a lot of people. I think that's really changed. I think people are starting to understand, and people in the heartland, I hate that word, but people are really starting to understand that this is a big problem, and it's a real problem, and it's a generational problem. So I think that's part of it. The other thing is, I mean, frankly, I think things like Arcasanti are like fun kind of utopian ideas. This is about building in real cities where real people live and have real needs. We know in New York City we have 1 million people that are going to come into the city in the next decade. We do not have anywhere near the housing supply that we need to house those people. And so, you know, these are real places with real problems, not simply ideas that are out there, you know, that are gestating. It's about actually the sort of facts on the ground. Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe this sort of population pressure might actually end up generating not necessarily a million more people in New York City, but maybe some.
I think we're going to get both. The million growth number is actually quite tepid. You know, our competitor cities are growing at a much faster rate than we are. London and Tokyo are way ahead of us in terms of planning for growth and change, way ahead of us. Boy, tough question. You know, I look at cities like I do the creation of art or architecture or anything else, which is you have to take the good with the bad. That fundamentally, look, I hate the fact that things are getting more vulgar, and I raise 2 kids near Union Square, and I walk them to school, and they hear all sorts of things that I wish they didn't, and often they're being spoken by people in business attire, and it drives me crazy. So I understand what you're saying, but I would still rather raise my kids that way. I'm glad they walk to school and don't have little chubby rolls around them because they get driven to school every day in their minivan. And so I just think you take the good with the bad. The other thing I would just say is I'm always very leery of comparisons to other parts of the world in terms of, a couple of years ago in the Bloomberg administration, I was part of the Bloomberg administration, but there became this sort of weird fascination with Copenhagen, right? Like, you know, everyone bikes everywhere, and this is where you can get your farm-raised, you know, Swiss chard and all of this stuff. Great. That's great if you're Copenhagen. If you're a polyglot society where you basically don't allow any immigration, you have a bunch of oil sitting off the coast of Denmark, And, you know, you have taxation rates at 60 or 70%, and business creation's incredibly low, right? That's not New York City. It's certainly not the place I wanted to move to when I moved here. And so if I have to trade some vulgarity and some of the roughness and toughness of a place like New York for kind of this genteel version of life that seems to have found its way to the museum cities of Europe, I'll take it any day. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
How is that sustainable with so many services? Number two, of an earlier slide, you showed the cluster of farmers in Japan with the fields all spread out. How do you feel about, and there is such a notion afloat of buildings, large urban buildings just for agriculture, where they control the light, the food for the plants, there are no bugs, no gardens. And three, what's your favorite answer to fossil fuels as energy?
Oh, boy. So on the surface question, the amount of surface we've got is going to be the same regardless of... So, I mean, this building is a bit of a trick of the eye. These are like two very standard buildings. You couldn't put them together. The building would be too deep, right? They're actually two very standard buildings that just have a bridge condition at the top that makes it into something more interesting. So it's actually fairly... Here, maybe this one will give you... So in other words... That's a fairly standard residential tower, as is that. If you put them together to get less surface, it would be too wide a tower. So you have to have that separation. So it's only really that that's creating something a bit more interesting, but it's really about this notion. Our thought was that when you're in a great waterfront neighborhood, you feel the water before you get to the water. And so that the way the light dances around the inside of those buildings will help give you some sense of that. Japan, vertical farming. I had students who actually looked at this for Governor's Island and had this idea about towers of vertical farms on Governor's Island and hydroponics. They had some really interesting results. So I actually think it's quite positive. I mean, there was a question asked earlier about agricultural farming, and I actually think that sprawl has led to agricultural farming. That sprawl has so threatened small farmers that it's only agricultural farming that has now, you know, sort of taken over the land that's left, basically, because it's so hard for farmers to get their produce to market. And so my one worry about all this urban farming talk is, what are we doing to the local farming ecology? And then in terms of favorite alternative fuel, you know, this one's a tough one, and I do think that there are steps to it. In other words, so natural gas, which is still a fossil fuel, but is a lower emission fossil fuel. So in India, for example, all the fleet vehicles a few years ago by Supreme Court order were converted to compressed natural gas. So the cities like New Delhi, Calcutta, Mumbai, they had horrible air quality, and now... It's amazing. The cities are all verdant again. You can breathe the air again because they took all the fleet vehicles, the taxis, the buses, the delivery vehicles, and converted them to compressed natural gas. That, to me, is not a final solution. It's an interim solution. But I find it astonishing that a country as impoverished as India could figure this out, and we get excited because we now have a cab that gets, you know, 27 miles to the gallon instead of 23, right? I don't understand. Like, we should be able to convert all of our buses, all of our taxis, all of our FedEx vehicles, all of our delivery vehicles to either electric zero emission, which is could be potentially solar powered, could be a bunch of different things, or hydrogen cells or natural gas. But I think we're going to need some stepping stones to getting to truly renewable fuel, right? But something in between.
Related to that last bit, many of us worry that the production of natural gas by hydrofracturing.
Oh yeah, that's a terrible idea. No, I totally agree. That's a terrible idea. No, this goes back to, again, we know that if you just take 20% of the fossil fuel from the known resources, we've created calamitous climate change. So forget about hydrofracking, forget about Keystone XL, forget about all of these now high-tech mechanisms that they're trying to use to extract every last drop of fossil fuel, right? If you just use the stuff that we know we've got big problems. So that's a terrible idea. But all I'm saying is, whether it's fusion or better solar or wind or whatever it is, that we probably need some bridge technology between where we are right now and where we need to get, probably. Hi.
I have two questions. One is about Ferguson,
what I think of Central Park. Oh yeah, Central Park is one of the greatest creations of humanity. I don't know what to say about Ferguson. I mean, it's. I honestly don't feel like I'm qualified to say anything about Ferguson. I mean, other than my own personal experiences growing up in Boston with the BPD, Well, I think you asked, I mean, the one piece that I can't, so Ferguson probably does not have a strong mayor, and it's interesting. As I travel, what I really notice is the places that don't have strong mayors have a lot more problems than the places that do. And that mayors, because, see, the interesting thing about mayors is that they affect the lives of thousands, maybe millions of people, but they're also directly accountable to their constituents. They live in that city. They have a relationship to their constituents that I think is fundamentally different than a president or a governor or even a congressperson who splits their time moving back and forth between their district and Washington. I just think that there's something about that fact that they live where they are actually doing their work is really important. I think Central Park is great. I mean, what's... I guess I don't understand quite the thrust of the question. To me, the reason I compared it to the river is there's certain similarities. Like, you think about these vast tracts of land that are basically, they're not quite natural, they're synthetically natural. Like, the park is a synthesis. But I think, again, it's extraordinarily important to create these pockets of nature, quote, in quotes, for people. Now, should it be that size versus a different size? I think it's great that we build grand gestures sometimes and we have, these amazing resources in our city. So, yeah, hi. My students, a few years back, actually before Storm Sandy and Irene, they did a really interesting piece of research, which was that the natural depth of New York Harbor is only about 16 feet, and so to bring the big ships in, and the ships are getting bigger because of this thing that they're doing at the Panama Canal, everyone's trying to get the bigger and bigger ships in, the Army Corps dredges a huge amount of soil from within New York Harbor to create the shipping channels and ships all that dirt to landfills in Pennsylvania and Texas. It's very expensive. And so they propose something really radical, which is to fill in the water between Lower Manhattan and Governor's Island and annex Governor's Island and create a new neighborhood called Lolo or Lower Manhattan for short. My students are interesting people. They then did the financial analysis on what Lolo would generate. Lolo was so valuable because you're creating more Manhattan, right? Lolo would basically generate like enough money to fund the state's education budget. It was enormous in terms of value creation. You could extend the subway lines, Governor's Island, the historic part would stay. It would finally become something because you could actually get there. But to me, the most interesting part of it was they did it all out of a concern about climate change, because what they proposed was that some of that money and dredge material would be used to create barrier islands around the harbor to protect the harbor in the event of storms. Now, when that came out, everyone thought, oh my God, these crazy students, their crazy professor. Then the storms hit, and now we're looking at a bunch of design proposals to build barrier islands in the harbor, but no one knows how to pay for it because no one's actually tied it to a development mechanism that would actually help you pay for it. I find it really interesting. If you look at Rotterdam and Amsterdam, people who know flooding issues very, very well, they're building right up against the water's edge. But they're doing things like creating, like, this park is designed to flood. It's designed to absorb water. It's permeable. We know that the site will flood during certain occasions. We know that the electrical equipment has to be pulled out of the basement. We know certain things about how to design a building in that circumstance. But the history of New York City is a history of land reclamation. And Hong Kong is doing it. Tokyo, one of the most environmentally sound societies on the planet, is doing land reclamation. We should at least bring back the debate about whether we need to create land in order to solve some of our issues. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
If you go anywhere in China, you'll just see these small buildings very efficiently planned. And I was just curious what your thoughts are. Vacant, yes, but they are planning for this huge migration. So.
Right. I mean, so, you know, I first went to China in 1992, where I actually saw an 80-story skyscraper built on a dirt road with chickens and pigs on it. And I thought it was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever seen. You know, the thing is, the Chinese planning mechanism is so extraordinarily powerful, and at some level, one has to envy it. We're building, you know, Jean mentioned in my intro that, you know, at the city, we figured out how to extend the number 7 line. It's going to open, I think, sometime next year. You know, it's a 2-kilometer, one-stop extension, right? We all jump up and down about this glorious achievement. Shanghai is going to build 200 kilometers of subway line, probably in the time that it took to plan and build the number 7. If we had the high-speed rail that they're running right now in China, the Harmony train, we could go from downtown Atlanta to downtown Manhattan in 3 hours. It would transform the eastern seaboard, and therefore the country. A third of the country's air traffic goes through our 3 airports. So it's something to envy at one level. At another level, it's not something to emulate, in the sense that, and this is where, that's why I showed that fingerprint image. What to me is basically missing in Chinese city planning is the humanity of it all. I mean, it has a machine-like quality that is, I have a hard time believing that's the future of humanity somehow. And that, you know, there's very little architectural quality. There are very few parks, central or otherwise. There just isn't this sense of human scale and human fabric. And going back to the mayor of Portland, one of the things he said to me about towers in Portland is, and it was a very wise thing to say, is that, you know, I don't care if there are towers in my city. What I care about is the first 30 feet. What's the experience of the sidewalk? What's the experience of the pedestrian? Where's the ground floor retail? What does the tree canopy look like, right? Are all of those things thought about? It's that, and I was telling Jean, I'm actually contemplating a second book that's sort of on this topic. What's missing in most of the global cities that are building at such a rapid rate is any sense of sort of a kind of glue at the street level, a kind of sense that it's a place you want to walk around and be. And that's the problem. It all looks right by the numbers. It's transit-oriented density. It's all of that stuff. But it's missing a basic sort of fundamental humanity that I think the Chinese themselves are waking up to. I mean, the Chinese have historically some of the greatest city building. I mean, Xi'an is basically the oldest city in the world. These folks know how to plan and build great cities. It's just the fact that through the course of, I would argue, a number of cultural and social upheavals, that that history has been forgotten. And I think they're trying to kind of find it back. Preservation, I mean, the amount of unbelievable urban fabric that Beijing and Shanghai have torn down, that are now, they're trying to, yeah, that they're now trying to sort of reclaim at some level. Those, I mean, we do certain things quite well in a place like New York. So, sure, sir. I think that's a bunch of hooey. I mean, well, look, plenty of people live in towers in this city. And furthermore, you know, we have been inundated with this imagery of public housing and towers being unsafe. It's nonsense. The fact is those towers are unsafe not because of their architecture or their scale, but because of an absolute abdication by society of how those buildings are managed. So I'll give you an example. There are plenty of tower in the park housing projects in Manhattan that you can point to that are actually extraordinarily successful. Go to Penn South, for instance, in the 30s on the west side. And you'll find a thriving community in those towers that look an awful lot like Cabrini Green and Pruitt Igoe and all of these places, the place that got blown up in The Wire, right? You know, that's not about the architecture. If you look at what happened to our public housing after Sandy, it was a scandal. You had grandmothers living on the 23rd floor who couldn't get food because their elevators didn't work. That wasn't because of the housing was poorly planned. It's because no one was maintaining the elevator. Right? I mean, so, you know, that to me is, there has to be a basic social compact. It sort of goes back to your question about this kind of degradation of a social compact. There has to be a basic social compact that we look out for each other, right? And actually communal living is much safer than living out in these sort of individual dwellings out in the landscape somewhere where God knows what can happen to you, that you need your neighbor. Right, those. I mean, that should not be such a hard and difficult thing. And I just can't abide the idea that by living in a hallway, I used to live in a building with a hallway. We used to all have parties together. No one had to drive anywhere. Right? It was a lot of fun. You'd walk down the hall at the end of the party. Right, that's just how people decide to live. That's not an architectural issue. That's a social issue. Yeah, I mean, if you don't decide to live there, that's your choice, unless I dictate it. But. Oh, the public housing. Yeah, but I think given there's been 11% rise in homelessness in the city in the last year, I think most of those people would rather live in public housing than not. It's like winning the lottery if you're homeless. But it's still, we just have a fundamental, I mean, it's scandalous. It's scandalous. There's nothing, just no reason that people should have to live like that. Anyway, I think we're going to call it a night, but thank you very much for your attention and your questions.